Morning.
That's better.
If you have a Bible to hand, you might want to turn with me to our reading this morning. It's Matthew 24, verse 36 to verse 34. It will make absolutely no difference whether you have the words in front of you or not, because I'm going to read from a different translation. But it might give you a clue as to where I'm heading. Matthew 24. And from verse 36. We're in a series, aren't we, looking at parts of the Apostles' Creed. And the part we've come to today is the part where we declare that he will come again. He will come again. What does that mean? What does it mean that Jesus is going to come again? That's what we're going to be thinking about this morning, and that's what this reading is talking about. So Jesus is speaking now. About that day and hour, no one sees. Neither the divine messengers of the heavens, nor, possibly, not the Son. Only the Father. For just as in the days of Noah, in this way will be the presence of the Son of Man. For just as they were in those days before the flood, crunching vegetation and drinking wine, marrying and giving in marriage, until that day Noah entered into the Tibar. They did not understand, right up until came the flood and took away each altogether. And like this will be the presence of the Son of Man. Then, two will be in the field. One will be taken from, and one released. Two grinding in the millstone, one is taken from and one released. Therefore, says Jesus, be awake. Because you do not see on what sort of day your master comes. But this you know. That if the master of the house has perceived in what sort of watch the thief comes, he would, in whatever way he can, have awakened and anyhow not permitted him to dig through his house. And because of this, you can be prepared. For in that not supposed hour, the Son of Man is coming. Who likes ambiguity? Yeah. So maybe we'll do this. Maybe. Maybe we won't. I don't know. Meh. Bothered. Who cares anyway? Go with the flow. Who's feeling profoundly uncomfortable at that thought? So who prefers certainty? Yes, if it's good. So on this day, at this time, this will happen. Guaranteed. According to plan. Planned for, worked on, strategized through, it's going to happen that way. With all the details worked out. Who's feeling happier? So what happens when we're not sure if a plan is a plan? Is it something we can bank on? Is it something we should put our hopes in? Or is it just a wish that might happen or might not happen? You know the difference between a hope and a wish? A hope is something rooted in reality. A wish isn't. What if what we think is a plan is just an aspiration? Is ambiguous. Something we shouldn't set store by. Because it might happen. Possibly. Maybe. One day. Is that the kind of plan that we would stake our lives upon? No, probably not. I was invited to a meeting this week, just gone by, and I'd met with this bunch of people about 3 months ago, and at the end of our last meeting, we'd sat together in this room, and we'd got our diaries out, and we'd said, when will this group meet again? And we'd thrown some dates out, and we'd agreed a date, and we'd agreed a time, and we'd agreed a place. And for me, it went straight in my diary. There you go. Saved. Bosh. In my diary. And because that date was in my diary, I moved things around. I knew it was coming. I made sure that I was available. Other things I could have done. I moved to be in different places so I could do all the things I needed to do, including the meeting that I'd scheduled in my diary. About 3 days before the meeting was due to take place, an email went out from the convener of this particular group to say, just confirming, as per our last discussion, that the meeting is going to be on this day, and at this time, and in this place, according to the conversation we were all part of. Are we all okay? And then the first message came back. I'm really sorry. I know we agreed the date. I know I was in the meeting, but I didn't put it in my diary. And now I've got another meeting that I really, 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 really must attend to. And then the next message came back and it said, I know we agreed the date. I was at the meeting and I was part of the discussion, but I've got a funeral that's come up and I need to take this funeral. And so I'm really sorry, but I can't be at the meeting. And then the next message came in and it said, I'm really sorry, but I've got a family commitment. And the next message came in and the next message came in and the next message came in. And from the 15 people that have been sat in this room agreeing the next meeting, 3 of us were available. That's not good. So was it a plan? When we sat in the same room, having the same conversation, why was it? Some of us got our diaries out straight away and went, save, booked in. And others of us went, well, I'll have a think about it. I might be available. Other staff might crop up and I'll let you know nearer the time. I need you to remind me 15 times before the next meeting to make sure it gets in my diary. And I was reminded of a parable that Jesus told. Anybody think of the parable that I'm thinking of? Yeah, so the parable of the great feast in Luke's gospel, where people are invited to the great feast in the heavens. But before when the invitation goes out, the great king, doesn't he, sends out this invitation. And says to his neighbours and he says to his friends, he says, come, we're holding a great feast. It's a great wedding banquet. We're celebrating this amazing event. Will you come? And people come back and they say, no, I'm too busy. I've got business I need to attend to. And other people said, I've got to bury my father who's died. And others said, I've got other commitments so I can't be there on that day. And what did the great king do? Was the great king happy? No, he was not. So the great king said to his servants, go out to the highways and the byways, go and find whoever you can lay your hands on and drag them into the feast, because they're welcome. The feast only works when it is populated, when it is filled with happy people celebrating this great event. Anybody ever been to a party that's been miserable? Maybe it's been a formal do and people don't really know one another and it's just a little bit miserable. And until, of course, enough alcohol has been consumed, in which case they forget their inhibitions and then it starts to happen, maybe. Anybody ever been to a miserable wedding?
Not your own.
Not your own. That would be telling. What a miserable thought, isn't it? Being at a wedding reception where nobody's happy. Where people are just going... That great day, that eschatological banquet at the end of time, is a day that's supposed to be filled with rejoicing, with celebration. Now, there's all sorts of reasons why Jesus gave the parable that he gave. There's all sorts of reasons why some of those who believe they should be at that encounter won't be there. The question that we're grappling with this morning, though, is what do we do when something we think is a plan, with details that have been communicated in advance, discussed and debated and we thought agreed, then doesn't happen? Or only a few people turn up. When things don't happen when or in the way that we're expecting or hoping, what's the first thing we do? What do you think was the first thing that happened in the email exchange that happened once people realised that this meeting of what was going to be 15 people was now 3 people? What was the first, the very next email about, do you think?
What day can you do?
Before that.
Ooh.
You should have reminded us. It was your fault that we're not available. Not our fault, we didn't put it in our diary. We're taking no responsibility at all for not being at the meeting. You should have reminded us. And so often, the way that we work through ambiguity, the way that we work through disappointment, the way that we work through the plan that has suddenly fallen apart, is that we can look for someone to blame. And I wonder, if you were in the scenario that I'm describing, I wonder how long you might carry your disappointment for. Because we're really good as human beings at holding a grudge. Once we've pointed the finger at somebody else, to then hold a grudge and remember that. So the next time the meeting's been convened, there will be some people kind of going, I don't trust that person. So I'm going to send out some messages in advance, make sure it's all happening the way that I'm expecting it to happen. If we're the convener of a meeting that hasn't happened, how long will we hold on to our feelings, maybe of guilt? I should have done better. Shame. It was all my fault, after all. How often do we think, I wonder whether I look incompetent in the eyes of my colleagues? Because when situations that we're expecting to happen the way we're expecting them to happen unravel, the ultimate end can be an impact on our sense of who we are, our ego, our soul. Now, some of us in that kind of scenario will respond by examining the details more closely. So what happened in this scenario is that the details weren't communicated effectively enough. Maybe people weren't sure of the date. Maybe people weren't sure of the time. Maybe people weren't sure of the location. Maybe people weren't sure of the purpose of the meeting. And so therefore, if we had more details, then we can make sure this doesn't happen the next time. We'll go back and we'll check the minutes of the last meeting to make sure that we did actually all agree to that day and that time. We'll check the details. We'll go back and we'll see who else was in the room when it was discussed. And we'll work out where does the ambiguity arise from. And then we can work out who was really responsible for messing the meeting up. Was it me? Was it you? Was it them? Some of us don't respond in that way, we respond in a different way. Some of us respond by spotting the new opportunity. So, some of the people that we expected to be here aren't now here. But, that's okay. Not a problem. We'll move on. We'll have the meeting with those that are available. We'll still have the meeting. We'll still have the conversation. We'll still do the stuff we need to do. And those that can't be here, that's their problem. We're moving on. We're moving on regardless. They'll just have to play catch up. Others respond in yet a third way. Maybe, just maybe, God doesn't want them people to be here, those people to be here. Maybe, just maybe, the three of us have gathered together in this room because there's only meant to be the three of us, and there's something important for the three of us to discuss and to discover. So maybe this is part of God's plan. And we can spiritualize the situation and we can ask some really good questions about what the Holy Spirit is doing in the face of and despite of our disappointment. We can assume that the situation is the way that it is because God is in control. And that's not a bad thing. But how does that leave others feeling? Who did have good reasons not to be there? Because as they see other people moving on, the question that they'll be asking is, that's all very well for God to have been with you in your situation, but what does that say to me about where God is in my situation? And the final way that some of us respond is to respond quasi-pastorally. Never mind, dear. Would you like sugar in your tea? So in the face of the same set of data, the same circumstances, the same scenario, we respond differently. And that's the problem we have with the way that the data, the situation, the scenario about Jesus' return has been handled for 2,000 years. In the face of the same set of data, the same circumstances, the same scenario, people have interpreted the data in different ways. They've created different theologies. They've created different ways of understanding what is actually happening here. And the way that the plan is understood keeps changing, because Jesus is nothing if not inconvenient. He doesn't do what we want him to do. Oh, darn it. If we were asking the question that we're asking about when Jesus is going to return in around about AD 35, about a year or so after Jesus died and rose again and ascended into heaven, the answer we would have heard most often is that we expect Jesus to return at any moment. In the space that it takes for my heart to beat one more time, Jonathan asked us to think about heartbeats a little while earlier, or in the space it takes me to draw another breath, my expectation is that Jesus is going to return. It is literally that imminent. Most, but not all, of Paul's letters are written through this lens. But just think for a moment, what would you do differently in your life if you thought Jesus was going to turn up in 1 minute's time? Would you cut the grass? Would you fix the leaky tap? Would you bother cooking a meal?
No.
Do you not bother cooking a meal anyway? Would you invest in relationships? Would you bother having children? Because once we grasp the story of Jesus returning any second now, we begin to understand the lens through which much of the New Testament was written. The expectation that so many things that we find important were not considered important because Jesus is about to return. Doesn't that make sense? And that's the lens that most of Paul's letters, all of Paul's letters, probably bar 2 Corinthians and Romans, were written through. The expectation that Jesus could return in the blink of an eye. But it's been an awfully long blink, isn't it? 2,000 years, almost, later. That's an awfully long blink. An awfully long breath. An awfully long heartbeat. And so the church, Christians, have had to wrestle with how we understand Jesus' return when he didn't do what we expected first off. How do we handle disappointment when things don't go the way we expect? Do we change the data? No, data is data. Do we change the scenario? No, the scenario's been told already. So we have to tell a different story. We have to create a different narrative. We have to, deep breath, change our theology. Because we have new data. We have new circumstances. Things are not as we expected. And we see in Paul's writings around about 56 to 58 AD that Paul's theology changes and he starts to grasp that Jesus is not about to return in the next second. In fact, Jesus isn't going to return probably in Paul's lifetime. We see in John's book of Revelation a similar shift in theology. We get glimpses of that theology in the Gospels, like the passage that we read earlier on today. The story has had to change because what we expected hasn't happened. So of course there are different people in different places and there are different ways of understanding the same basic story. And so there are those who pray fervently every hour of every day for Jesus to return. And they've surrendered their lives to live in such a way that they will be ready should he return at a moment's notice. At different times in history, the signs of the end of the age have been discerned. As far as I can tell from history, there have been about 42 different apocalyptic scenarios since Jesus walked the earth. And in every single one of them, prophets of doom said, "This is the moment." In the United States, in the Republican, Conservative, Evangelical Bible Belt in the South, the view of the planet, our environment, is to say we should destroy it as quickly as possible. We should hasten global warming. We should encourage the species depletion so that once the world is no longer able to support life, Jesus has to return. Pretty corrupt narrative, in my point of view. Pretty dodgy theology, from my point of view. Pretty irresponsible, from my point of view. But it is what is preached in the pulpits, in not all of them, but some of them, in that environment. If we kill the planet, then Jesus has to return. And so time and again, in different places and for different reasons, people have believed this is the time. Only for the world to keep turning. How do we handle a plan that isn't a plan? How do we deal with uncertainty in the face of what we want is certainty? And all sorts of theologies have emerged over the years to account for some of this. That view that I was talking about a moment ago in being preached in US pulpits, southern US pulpits, emerges out of a theology that was developed in the 1990s called dispensationalism. It's the theology, there's a series of books that were written called the Left Behind series, some of you might have read those. It's the theology that's contained within that series. The more time has passed, the more elaborate and the more extreme the theologies and the stories have become. Each wanting to take seriously, and hear that, I really mean that, they're trying to take seriously the teaching of Scripture, and they're trying to take seriously their real life experiences, like wars and famines and disease and all those kind of things. It's not that they're trying to be unhelpful. They are trying desperately to make sense of the world in which we live. More recently, there's been another strain in Christian theology that's been emerging, and this is a strand that says Jesus is not coming again. And there are two reasons that are given. The first is that it was never meant to be understood that way. The second, and that tends to be what we would broadly call liberal theology, the second comes from a quite conservative evangelical root. It's what we would describe as neo-Pentecostalism. And the theory, the theology, would go like this. Jesus has already returned. Because he returned at Pentecost. At Pentecost, the Spirit of Jesus came and became the Spirit of the church. And so we don't need Jesus to return again, because that would be for the third time. These are the kinds of people that will be engaging with things like signs and wonders and that kind of stuff. Now, I don't mind a bit of signs and wonders myself. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But there's a theological narrative that is emerging in some of these places that is asking serious questions, trying to take theology and our experience seriously, and coming up with these stories. So we need to recognise that these are ways that mainstream Christian traditions have tried to grapple with this question. And they've come to vastly different conclusions. Oh boy, that makes it hard work, doesn't it? What are we supposed to think? What are we supposed to believe? How are we supposed to respond if within mainstream Christian traditions there's all these different points of view? I haven't even begun exploring the points of view of those that aren't in mainstream Christian traditions. There are some really wacky ideas out there. From that Jesus is a spaceman. And he's going to return one day in a great big spaceship. And we're all going to be sucked. This guy 2001, isn't it? Do, 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 do. There are those that think that the earth is going to remain forever. And a few thousand are going to be transported to heaven, and they've got their own ways of understanding that kind of stuff. There are so many different ways of looking at this stuff out there. What are we supposed to think, and how are we supposed to believe? Well, the good news is that Jesus knew that this was a difficult question for us. 2,000 years ago, Jesus knew this was a difficult question that we would be facing. And it's actually the same question that was being asked of Jesus in his own day. in answer to Jesus' question about who the Messiah was, the Pharisees knew the answer to the question. When Messiah comes, he will make known the mysteries of God. So the question then became, when will Messiah come? To which the answer the Pharisees gave was, we don't know. We don't know. We know it has been promised, but we don't know all the timing. The detailed planning people that I was referring to earlier on, those that like details, want to that certainty, etc., etc., inside their heads right now are probably thinking, that's not good enough. I want an answer. And maybe they're thinking, I'll keep looking in Scripture until I find the clues, because they've got to be there somewhere. Those who are quick to move on and to embrace the future, regardless of who they might be leaving behind, might now be thinking, so how do we lead into a future that is so uncertain? And maybe they're thinking, action. Any action is better than inaction whilst we wait. The spiritually inclined may now be thinking, so what do we do in the meantime? What is God telling us to do whilst we wait? And the quasi-pastoral people are thinking, look at all those people thinking about really tough stuff. What they need is another cup of tea. And the point of our thinking this morning is simply this. However, whenever, or wherever we ask these questions, there is an answer given by God. Given by God through his only begotten Son, Jesus Christ. Who, being in the very nature God, did not think equality with God with something to be desired, but instead humbled himself. And who gave the most simple and the most profound answer to this question. And his answer has not changed. And his answer is this. I don't know. Possibly. I don't know. Possibly. Oh, I love that possibly. Oh, it's there in the Greek, it's not there in the English. The messengers of God, those beings that we sometimes describe as angels, certainly do not know and cannot reveal the future. The people that we sometimes hear about as being with God in heaven, the saints, do not know. Guaranteed. Human beings who are alive today, or who have been alive in the last 2,000 years, do not know. However clever and however plausible the story they create, and however plausible the theology they create, they do not know. They are fabricating based on evidence according to their own inclinations. They do not know. And however much they claim it has been spiritually revealed, they do not know. For certain. Even Satan has not got a clue. Friends, do not be deceived. That's not the point. The only one who actually knows the details is God the Father. And possibly the Son. But he's not telling. Darn it. The only detail the Son has revealed is maddening. It's not when you expect it. Oh! Which is what proves that every way of constructing this from a human point of view, however spiritually discerned people will tell you this is, however convicted people tell you they are, the only thing that has been revealed is that they do not know. Because they cannot know. Because that would defeat the very teaching of God himself and make God out to be a liar. Dangerous ground. Jesus will return when it is not expected. If you knew that while you were sitting here there was a burglar breaking into your house, would you still be sitting here? Anybody? If you knew the hour, if you knew the time, then what would happen in our society? If Jesus said, okay, so the time is 1 week from now, 11:30 p.m, I'm going to turn up. What would happen in society for the next week? Anarchy. But more than that. Chaos. More than that. What it would mean is that you could do whatever you liked in this coming week. You could be as sinful as you wanted to be. And at 11:29 next Sunday morning, you could throw yourself on your knees, you could take bread and wine and say, God, I'm sorry, and know it's been forgiven. There would be no incentive for holy living. There would be no incentive for discipline. There would be no incentive to live according to God's prompting, leading by his Spirit. And that's the point. And that's why we don't know. That's why it's not been revealed. God's plan is not to frustrate those who want answers. Although it does. Be honest. God's plan is to keep us awake, spiritually. To keep us alert, spiritually. To keep us listening, spiritually. To keep us sensitive to his Spirit. Why? That's the real question this morning. It's not the what and the how, it's the why. Because we're not invited to be awake or alert, to be looking for the signs of the times. That, quite frankly, is a waste of time and effort. We are to be awake and alert so that when he returns, we may be found ready. The parable of the 10 bridesmaids, however you want to interpret that, those that were ready with the pots of oil and stayed awake for the bridegroom, and those that weren't ready, that let the oil lamp go out, so when the groom came, they were found asleep and slack and not expectant. We are called to be awake. We are called to be alert. We are called to be listening. We're called to be found ready. But ready for what? Ready to recognize him when he comes. Ready to welcome him when he comes. Ready to acknowledge him when he comes. Ready to worship him when he comes. But is it just me? Or do you not think we can do all those things now? We can acknowledge him now. We can worship him now. We can be ready for him now. And that's the point. That's the point. If we are in that place where we are looking for and connecting with the presence of Jesus now, then it makes no difference whether we are here on the earth or whether we're in the heavens, wherever and whatever they might be. It makes no difference. It makes no odds. Because we're ready. And we're alert to his presence. And we're living in his presence. And so, friends, I want to lovingly, carefully, and in the most considerate way I possibly can, say to you that this theology is all very nice. But it's an awfully big red herring to the way most people think. It's the biggest conundrum that we're never going to solve. And for most people it just gets in the way. And it stops us from understanding the point. The point is this. Jesus is here. Jesus is here. Jesus is now. Doesn't matter when he comes back in a physical manifestation. Doesn't matter how he comes back in a physical manifestation. Doesn't matter whether we're alive to see it or whether we're not. The point is, Jesus is here. And there's one other further point. And I've alluded to it already. Jesus is here and has given us a job. And if we spend all of our time looking for the signs of the times and trying to understand what's going on, we miss the point of what we are called to do. Yes, we're called to be in his presence, but we've got another equally important task to do. And it is this. To go to the byways and the highways. And to make sure the celebration in heaven when it takes place is filled with joy. Friends, our job is not to sit in small circles pondering all these deep things that we're never going to ever get an answer to. Our job is to fulfill the calling of the kingdom. So friends, I want to simply say to you this morning, don't be distracted. Don't be distracted. Don't be distracted by man's narrative. Don't be distracted by spiritual sounding speak. Keep the main thing the main thing. Stay in the presence of God. And do all you can to populate his kingdom. Keep the main thing the main thing.